is Clark versus Sargent Irrigation District. Mr. Krejci, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice.
And is it Mr. Norton? Good morning to you, and will you be arguing for your side? Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Very good, then. Mr. Krejci, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Before I begin, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
All right. May it please the court, counsel, students. My name is Jared Krejci, and I represent the appellants, Sargent Irrigation District, and Don Clark, who is a co-manager of Sargent Irrigation District. To begin with, I wanted to talk about one of the issues in this case, which is under Section 13-906, the definition of final disposition. Before you is one issue, which is whether the Board of Directors of the Sargent Irrigation District made a final disposition on the appellee's written claim for damages.
What's the basis for our appellate jurisdiction of that issue?
The basis for appellate jurisdiction, are you talking about the final order statute and how it was revised to explicitly allow governmental immunity cases to be before you?
I understand how that statute would give us appellate jurisdiction of the court's denial of summary judgment on the basis that the discretionary function exemption does not apply. What I'm asking about is, how do we have appellate jurisdiction of the other issue you're raising? Is that also based on an assertion of sovereign immunity?
Your Honor, the answer that I have is based in two parts. The first response is, in 2021, in Great Northern Insurance Company versus Transit Authority of City of Omaha, the issue of a pre-suit claim issue was appealed directly from a denial of summary judgment to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took jurisdiction of that issue and didn't get into a deep analysis as to whether the change to the final order statute allowed that or did not allow that. So it's been done in the past, Justice, and the more analytical answer, I believe, comes from State versus Wilson. And State versus Wilson is a case involving the statutory speedy trial right. And as you know, the statutory speedy trial right is in what would otherwise be an interlocutory order that is immediately appealable. And the constitutional speedy trial right is not such an immediately appealable final order. And in State versus Wilson, the Court of Appeals stated, citing State versus Lloyd, which is the Supreme Court, that in State versus Wilson, the Court of Appeals stated that it has pendant jurisdiction over the issue of the constitutional issue, which on itself is not a final order that's reviewable on appeal. But since it is brought along with a non-frivolous claim for a statutory violation, once you have a non-frivolous order that is appealable, then you can address issues that otherwise on their own would not be immediately appealable, but once they're there, there is appellate jurisdiction.
So you would agree this issue would on its own otherwise not be appealable, but your argument is once you have an appealable issue, you can sweep up other things along with that?
Well, I think you can look at it that way. That's what State versus Wilson and State versus Lloyd would say. The other interpretation of Great Northern Insurance Company versus Transit Authority of City of Omaha is that the pre-suit issues are tied into governmental immunity and they are immediately appealable under the revised final order statute. To go back to the final disposition, Your Honors, as you know, the first...
No, I want to go back to your argument just a second. So in the State versus Wilson context, if there had been a discovery dispute whereby a motion for some sort of discovery had been denied, Are you contending that the Court of Appeals would have had jurisdiction not just over the speedy trial issues, but also over the discovery issue?
I'm not sure if I'm contending that, Your Honor, but...
So what's the dividing line, in a theoretical sense, between the issue that clearly the statute does provide jurisdiction for and the other things that you are suggesting come along with it?
The cases do not suggest an explicit dividing line. If we're in an area of ambiguity and I had to suggest a dividing line that would be appropriate, I think the dividing line would be one that essentially decides the case. In this case, we have two issues on appeal. Either one can effectively decide the case. A discovery dispute typically is not an issue that is dispositive.
Is another possibility that State versus Wilson and State versus Lloyd were wrong in the sense that they brought along the constitutional claim with the speedy trial statutory claim? And I suspect I might have had something to do with State versus Wilson.
I didn't catch the author of those opinions, Your Honor, but based on what we have, I'm not arguing that they're wrong. I think that this case fits into the context that we have already provided, or you've already provided, so...
You would agree that jurisdiction in Nebraska is purely statutory?
I would.
And the statute that you're relying on to convey jurisdiction on the appellate court, in this instance the Supreme Court, is subsection 4 of section 25-1902.
So I have subsection 1D.
1D. It's the fourth part. It's the fourth sub. It's the new one.
Yes.
Over the years, we've referred to them as types 1, 2, and 3. This is now what we might call, for shorthand, the type 4.
Yes.
And just from a textual standpoint, how would you get from the text of that statute to the other issues you think come along?
I think you can get from the text of the statute to appellate jurisdiction of this pre-suit notice issue. And the reason is because the statute talks about sovereign immunity or the immunity of a government official. And sovereign immunity and governmental immunity are intrinsically tied into the notice requirements.
So is final disposition part of that immunity?
Our current cases state that the final disposition is an affirmative defense, which is not strictly immunity. In the past, I believe that it was immunity. My position is that these notice requirements are just so tied into immunity, and immunity is so important in the context of the political subdivision Tort Claims Act and the State Tort Claims Act, that there's a statutory hook there from the type 1D to the pre-suit notice requirements, and that was apparently what was done in Great Northern Insurance Company earlier this year.
Counsel, can you direct me to where in our appellate record we would find a clear indication that you raised a claim presentment defect before the district court? I don't see it in the Bill of Exceptions. I don't see it in the trial court's order addressing the issues that were raised. Where would I find it?
You would find it, Your Honor, and the case that the appellees have raised is Weider on this issue. And there is also a Political Subdivisions Act claim. And Weider is very distinguishable from this case because the appellees had actual notice that this was at issue. The first pleading notice that they had was that in the motion to dismiss, which was converted into a motion for summary judgment, I raised that they failed to comply with the procedural requirements of the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act.
But you didn't say which procedural requirements, correct?
It was broadly
pled.
Yes.
So where in the record do I see the claim presentment defect that you're arguing to us now?
You do not see me cite a statute in a pleading or an oral argument, but the touchstone here is fair notice, and fair notice is about factual pleading. Defenses are subject to the same pleading rules that we have for complaints. And in this case, the facts were pled. They had the minutes of the meeting, which is the number one exhibit in this case. They had that attached to my motion to convert the motion for summary judgment, or motion to convert the motion to dismiss into a motion for summary judgment well before the hearing. They had the annotated statement of facts. They had the index of evidence. They had the exhibit. In oral arguments, I raised this issue of the timeline and how the claim was presented. There was discussion at the meeting, and the complaint was filed all within 6 months. And that happened without objection. All of those things that I've discussed are all distinguishable from Weider. In Weider, the motion to dismiss was under-inclusive in that it stated that I believe the case was decided on the filing early issue. And in Weider, the motion to dismiss cited something different, such as that there was no notice. And so it was under-inclusive. In my instance, my motion to dismiss was over-inclusive. And after that, there were several steps of seeing the evidence, seeing the statement of facts, seeing the index of evidence, oral argument.
Thank you, counsel. I think you're out of time. Chief, may I ask one more question before the counsel
certainly
sits down?
May.
Thank you. With respect to your primary argument that the discretionary function exemption applies in this case, what evidence was offered to the district court of a policy or procedure that gave the sprayer, the person spraying the spray, the weed killer, discretion?
There was none, Your Honor.
So you didn't offer any evidence of a policy or procedure that gives the employee discretion?
No, and may I explain why I believe that's relevant? This case is very comparable to Williams versus City of Lincoln. And in that case, they did introduce evidence of a policy that gave some discretion. It's our position that there was no policy, which is the most absolute discretion that you can have. It's our position that there were no written requirements for the job. There was absolute discretion that he could have under the general law. So it's our position that the absence of a policy is a factor that shows discretion, because generally a policy can only limit discretion when otherwise discretion's wide open.
So the discretionary function was everything?
Well,
how to mix the herbicide, how to spray the herbicide, whether to do it or not do it. Those issues were discretionary?
Those are issues of discretion under the exemption.
So how do you address the statute that says you can only do it thus and such?
Yes. The Pesticides Act is addressed by Stonacek and Claypool. And Stonacek and Claypool mean that the Pesticides Act is not applicable to this case in any way because it's not a private right of action. In Stonacek and Claypool, there were statutory and regulatory requirements to tell the political subdivision what to do, how to do it, and reduce discretion. Those were violated. The Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, in either case, in those cases, said that those statutes and regulations are not relevant because they're
But in those cases, weren't the plaintiffs trying to rely on those statutes as the basis for their claim?
Yes.
And here, don't we have a more general negligence theory where the statute is only being used to establish the absence of discretion?
In this case, so far, the only statutory basis that the appellees have raised to limit discretion is the Pesticides Act.
But I understand your reliance on Stonacek and Claypool, but don't we have to extend those cases a bit farther than they went themselves in order to give you the result that you're seeking?
Your Honor, if I may try to rephrase your question and try to answer that, I think what you're asking is, if there was no Pesticides Act, is there a general duty to not damage other people's property? Is that...
No, my question is, My understanding of Stonacek and Claypool is that they were answering different questions than this case. Am I wrong in that?
I don't think they were answering different questions, Your Honor. I think it's about whether it's a private right of action and whether it's relevant to limiting discretion.
So your position is that the only statutes that can limit discretion are those that also provide a private right of action?
For purposes of the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act and when it interacts with the discretionary function exception.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Norton, good morning to you again, and you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. It's an honor to be in front of you again today. May it please the court and all these students. I'm not used to this big of an audience when I talk to you guys, but I guess I'll just jump right in. I've got my colleague Nick Ridgway, who's sitting at the table, has worked with me on this case. And has told anybody who will listen that he was supposed to argue it, and I took it away from him. But we represent Don and Kimberly Clark, the plaintiffs in this case. Don went out to his field one day in July of 2019 and noticed that he had damage to his corn. He started doing some investigation, spoke with Sergeant Irrigation District. It was pretty quickly determined that a ditch rider, Mr. Chris, who's one of the named defendants in this case, had sprayed a mixture of herbicides composed of whatever happened to already be in the tank and the other stuff that he added to it. Several agronomists looked into that and said, yeah, all these chemicals are what damaged your corn. There was a process called volatilization where the chemical actually vaporized, blew with the wind, damaged our corn. That's what brought us into this whole process. There were multiple conversations over the course of that year with Sargent Irrigation District, and it's, as you'll see from the record, our client Don Clark is actually one of the directors of the Irrigation District, and so he was a part of those conversations. In July of 2020, a formal written notice under the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act was submitted, or in June of 2020. On July 7th of 2020, there was a board meeting of the directors of the district at which they decided to follow their attorney's advice and to deny the claim, which was then communicated to...
Is that what they decided? To deny the claim?
That is what they decided.
Is that what the minutes reflect?
So the minutes state that they received a recommendation from their attorneys, Matson and Ricketts, that at this time not to settle the claim with Don Clark and to not overrule the insurance company.
Is that synonymous with denying?
Well, I believe it is, and you know, some of the evidence that the... Well, first of all, this issue wasn't
argued. What's the importance of the at this time?
I believe the importance was at this time, at the present moment, we're making a decision to deny this claim. Had this issue been raised in the district court, Mr. Clark would have testified, hey, I was at that meeting. Yeah, they denied the claim. I drafted those minutes. That's what they meant. We didn't have fair notice that this was even at issue. Therefore, we didn't put that evidence on. I have an email in my notebook from the irrigation district saying...
Is that in our record?
It's not.
Okay.
Again, it would be, but I mean, it says, last night the board took action. They denied your claim. So that was never an issue that was on our radar until the first briefing came out in this case. And apparently it wasn't on the district court's radar either.
Is that a jurisdictional issue or affirmative defense?
I presume that it falls under, it should have been raised as an affirmative defense, but there's also kind of this squishy area with affirmative defenses and a motion to dismiss. There was never an answer filed in this case. I think that if the defense counsel had argued specifically under 13906 at the time of the hearing, or had put any facts, any allegation in the statement of facts that there was no final disposition of the claim, then we would have been on notice and would have responded accordingly to that. You know, I don't believe that that issue is properly before this court. I don't think this court has the jurisdiction to review that decision because of the long-standing tradition and case law in the state that this court will not, the district court can't err on an issue that's not presented to it for determination.
Unless it's jurisdictional, which then can be raised at any time by any party or by the court, sua sponte, is that correct?
I suppose that would be correct.
So either it's jurisdictional and we can look at it, or it's not jurisdictional and we can't look at it.
Well, it's jurisdictional in the respect that a sovereign immunity defense, according to our legislature, that there has to be, if there is sovereign immunity, then the lower court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear a case, at least is my understanding of that rule. But even if that issue was before the court properly, we got here on a motion for summary judgment, or a motion to dismiss converted to a motion for summary judgment. The only reference in the record, in the evidence, is these minutes from the July 7th, 2020 board meeting of the district, in which it says at this time, you know, the recommendation is at this time to not settle with Don Clark. At the very least, I got to think that that's an issue of fact as to whether that counts as a final disposition or not, that would benefit from discovery and further development in the course of litigation. We haven't gotten there yet in this case. So even if that issue is before the court, I think there's a pretty plain issue of fact as to the interpretation of what does this mean in the minutes, and there's no other evidence in the record to provide light on that. With regard to what the district court actually held in this case, the district court was considering only a claim for under the discretionary function exemption or discretionary duty exemption under 13.9.10 subsection 2. That's stated three times in the district court's order that there's a motion under 13.9.10 subsection 2. I'm denying the motion under 13.9.10 subsection 2. And the court, I think, found correctly, based on this Pesticide Act, it's not the only way to get there, but it's the most direct. Whether there's a private cause of action or not under the Pesticide Act is irrelevant. This case was not filed under the Pesticide Act, as some of the justices have referenced in your questions of Mr. Krejci. The case was filed because Mr. Chris acted unreasonably in applying an illegal mixture of pesticides in a manner that it would be reasonably foreseeable that someone would be harmed by that, and that someone is the downfield, downwind farmer whose crops actually were harmed. That's the basis. It's ordinary negligence. The Pesticide Act maybe provides some additional evidence as to what the standard of care should be for someone applying pesticides, but in this case, the only reason it was raised is because in order for the discretionary function exemption to apply, there has to be discretion. And this court has held, the Court of Appeals in the Williams case that plaintiff's counsel referenced, held that if there is a statute, rule, or regulation that prescribes the conduct at issue, then there's no discretion. That's the route that the district court took in denying the motion for summary judgment in this case. I believe that was a correct route, and I think this court should affirm that.
Can a statute that does not provide a private right of action show an absence of discretion sufficient to preclude application of the discretionary function exemption?
Absolutely, Justice Pavlik. The discussion on the Stonacek and Claypool cases brings that to light, I think. Those cases were not ordinary negligence. They were based strictly on statutory duties that were alleged to have been breached. And that was what those cases, that's what this court did when it looked at those cases, was say, is there a private right of action?
And I mean, things even other than statutes can preclude application of the discretionary function, right? You could have a policy or a rule, and those wouldn't come with a private right of action.
Correct. I mean, the Court of Appeals holding in Williams is pretty broad, that if there's any statute, rule, or regulation that prescribes the conduct at issue, that's enough to overcome the discretionary element of the discretionary function exemption. I think those cases are easily distinguishable on that basis. I don't have a whole lot to add other than one quote from this court in Norman v. Ogallala Public School District, back in 2000, that the political subdivision remains liable for the negligence of its employees at the operational level, where there is no room for policy judgment. At its barest essence, that's what this case is. There's an allegation that Mr. Crist was negligent, and there's no exception that applies to protect Sergeant Irrigation District from that negligence. So unless justices have questions, I have nothing further to add.
Do you wish to weigh in on whether we have appellate jurisdiction of the claim presentment issue?
I don't believe you have appellate jurisdiction of the claim presentment issue because it wasn't presented in the district court.
Well, this question is based on 25-1902.
And I don't have much of an opinion on that, Justice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me, before you sit down, I'm not sure that this is relevant to anything. How does the fact that your client was a board member of the irrigation district, does that affect any of this at all? For example, you have an allegation of improper supervision or training for the employee. Would your client be one of the people who is supposed to supervise and educate?
Well, I see I'm out of time, but if I might answer that.
Please.
It is an interesting situation. Mr. Clark is a board member. It's a small irrigation district. He's one of three board members. I believe when this process initially started, there was a fourth board member who passed away before we actually got to a denial of the claim. The short answer is no. I don't think that the board necessarily is tasked with the operational detail of the district. There's a general manager and a staff that work for three different irrigation districts. They're a shared management team. I think those are the individuals ultimately responsible for setting policies and making sure employees are appropriately supervised and trained. In other words, this isn't a working board, so to speak, in that it's making all of the day-to-day decisions. It does present some angst, I suppose, to have a board member suing the irrigation district that he's a board member of. And for that reason, he's recused himself from discussions and from voting on issues that touch on this claim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments in Clark versus Sargent Irrigation District. Counsel, again, you are excused. You may leave if you wish. We are going to have some